Well, good morning, everyone. It is my privilege this morning to share the word with you. I was thinking about that phrase as I was sitting back there, and I thought, you know what? It's kind of like sharing a meal, and this morning has been a fantastic covered-ish lunch so far. What I have prepared here is more of a cooking show, I think, if we're running this analogy out. I want to kind of take you on my journey along here. And it's one of those things where when you have something prepared, it seems that everything else is connected. When you don't have something prepared, you don't notice it. So as we have been going along this morning, everything seems to be connected to the thing that I wanted to share on. I'm going to be speaking about the Sabbath, it turns out. And I actually had gotten most of the way through preparing for this morning, and I almost threw it all away. I decided, I don't want to talk about the Sabbath. I want to focus us instead on Christ. Like Paul, I know nothing but Christ and him crucified. And so I was in a bit of a conundrum because I had, I got 4 pages of notes here or something. And I was like, yeah, maybe I'll just toss this all out. And so I was thinking and I was praying. And as I was, I came across something. It's this absolutely indispensable principle of Bible study that I've heard about a few times. And that's total reliance on God's Holy Spirit. And it turns out that I didn't need to throw it away after all. So we're going to start this morning in Exodus 31. You don't have to, I'll read it to you. Then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have called by name these two guys of the tribe of Judah. I have filled them with the Holy Spirit, with skill, ability, knowledge, and all kinds of craftsmanship to design artistic works in gold, silver, and bronze, to cut gemstones for settings, to carve wood so that he may be a master of every craft." Oh, and then he has this second guy that's an assistant. Exodus 25 through 31 are all instructions on how to build the tabernacle. Its furniture, its tools, the priestly clothing. There's one little piece about sacrifice in there. Now, all of this whole chunk is a fantastic picture of how God interacts with his people, how we interact with him. But none of that is what we're looking at today. If you're reading this passage, if you're reading this section of scripture, and you aren't ready to do a kind of an in-depth study, it's kind of a lot of uninteresting details. After you've read it once, it's kind of like reading an instruction manual for a toaster. You kind of know what it's going to say, and the color of thread that is supposed to be used in Aaron's underwear, or how to make a fork for the tabernacle, it just doesn't make a whole lot of difference in your daily life. One day, I'm sure I will share a message called "From Underwear to Utensils," but that is not the message for this morning. It is a good title, though. I'm going to keep it in my box of clever things to say later. So I was reading Exodus 31, and I saw something that I had never seen before. And now I'm not talking about insight into something that I had not previously realized. I'm not talking about the Holy Spirit highlighting something to me. I'm talking about something brand new, something I didn't know was in the Bible. I don't know how many times I've read through this particular passage. I'm going to guess 20 something. And I was shocked that this was in there. I'm very rarely surprised at what's in the Bible these days. I've read it a lot. I'm pretty familiar with it. And yet I read a verse, my mouth dropped open because it suddenly put into context a question that had been rolling around in my head, and it's been rolling around my head for years. And that question is, this is what we're going to get into this morning, is why are Jesus and the Pharisees always fighting about the Sabbath? I sort of understand, but I've never really gotten down to the bottom of, like, what is going on here? I don't understand it. So what we're going to do, again, this is a cooking show. I'm going to take you along through, and then we're going to get to the end. And so some messages, like, here is a prepared dish that just goes on the table. I'm going to show you how to cook this one. So there are seven stories, real stories, not made up stories, actual factual accounts of this, you can call it a conflict or perhaps a confrontation in the Gospels. Matthew and Mark both mention two stories, the same two stories. Luke adds two more stories on top of that, and then John adds three more on top of that. There's seven stories in all. So I want to walk us through these stories so we can get a picture of what was going on so that perhaps we can understand why Jesus was doing what he was doing. The first three passages seem to be incidental. I have a feeling they're not. It doesn't seem like there was a whole lot that happened with Jesus that just was incidental. There wasn't a whole lot of coincidence, it doesn't seem. But they seem to be. So we'll start with the first one that seems to be the most incidental. It's in Luke. It says, on the Sabbath day, while he was walking through the grain fields, as one does on the Sabbath day, his disciples plucked and ate some heads of grain, rubbing them in their hands. But the Pharisees said, why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath? And Jesus answered them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat? And he also gave it to those with him. And then he said to them, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. Mark adds one more sentence, which is, the Sabbath was not made for man, but man for the Sabbath. Jesus and his disciples are just walking. The disciples took some grain, rubbed it in their hands, and ate it. And it was a big deal to the Pharisees. The next two stories are about healings. And these healings happen not in secret, but Jesus is kind of intentional about making it known that he was doing them. Now, this walk through the grain field, I have a feeling they walked a lot, and so it might have just happened to be on the Sabbath. These next two healings do happen on the Sabbath, and I don't know if they just happened to be on the Sabbath or if Jesus did them on purpose on the Sabbath, but he did kind of go out of his way in these two stories to make sure that it wasn't at least immediately known that it was him. And the first one is a man born blind, and the second one is the lame man by the pool of Bethesda. So we'll start with the second one. After these things, this is John 5. After these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And there's a pool that's called Bethesda. I don't think I'm going to read all of this. But there's a man, he was been there 38 years. And Jesus asks him if he wants to be healed. He says, yes, I want to be healed. Jesus heals him and says, pick up your mat and walk. And so we'll skip down a bit. Now it was Sabbath on that day. And the Jews were saying to the man who was cured, it is Sabbath. It is not permissible for you to carry your pallet. But he answered them, he who made me well, he told me to pick up your pallet. And there's some question and answer, and he doesn't know what's going on. Like, he doesn't know who it was. Jesus finds him later. And so then he tells the Jews it was Jesus. And so this, it says, for this reason, the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. And he answered them, and he said, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. So this was also on the Sabbath day. And now, in chapter 9, they brought the man who was previously born blind. This is also just a fantastic story. There's so much context before this, but we'll be here all day. So they brought the man who was previously blind to the Pharisees. Now it was Sabbath, on the day that Jesus had made mud and opened his eyes. So Jesus had spit into the dirt, made mud, rubbed it on this guy's face, and healed him. And the Pharisees also were asking him how he received his sight again, because they had had this conversation before, and they also were having some issues here. They couldn't quite figure some things out. And so he says to them, he applied mud to my eyes, and I washed, and now I see. That's the whole story. Therefore, some of the Pharisees were saying, this man is not from God. He cannot be from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. And so there's this, when I'm reading this, I keep seeing these things and I say, but surely they can see that healing somebody should, like, there are specific exceptions for things that you can do on the Sabbath. Apparently, pushing electrical buttons is not one of those things. But there are certain exceptions. Surely, healing somebody on the Sabbath should be an exception. But in their minds, it was not. And I don't know why. I don't know what's going on. So those are the first three seemingly incidental Sabbath confrontations. The next four seem to be that Jesus is very intentionally provoking some people. It's pretty obvious here. So on another Sabbath day, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. So he walked up front here, and he began teaching. And there was a man there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him. So Jesus has this habit of doing things on the Sabbath that ought not be done. And so the scribes and the Pharisees are sitting there. They know he's up front. They know his teaching. And they're waiting for him. They're just watching to see, so that they might find a reason to accuse him. But he knew their thoughts. And he said to the man with the withered hand, come up here and stand here beside me. So he's in front of everybody. This is why it seems fairly intentional. He brings the man up front. And then he asks the Pharisees, who are sitting wherever they were, watching him very carefully, is it lawful to do on the Sabbath to do good or harm, to save life or destroy it? He wasn't asking specifically, can I heal this man? He was asking more of a ideological question. And apparently they don't say anything. It doesn't record that they say it anything. And so he looks around at them all. Apparently there's no response. So he says, stretch out your hand. And he did so. And the man's hand was restored. And their reaction is, they were filled with fury and they discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. At this point, it seems like he's doing it on purpose. It seems that way, anyway, to me. He does it again in a few more chapters. This is chapter 13. Now he is teaching in the synagogue on the Sabbath. It's almost the same thing. This time it's a woman who has a disabling spirit. She's bent over. She can't stand up. And Jesus heals her. And the ruler of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, he says this fantastic thing. There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, not on the Sabbath day. And the Lord answered him, you hypocrites, don't each of you on the Sabbath day untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day? There are exceptions. You know there are exceptions for work on the Sabbath day. This is one of those exceptions. You should know this is one of those exceptions, but they don't know it's one of those exceptions. And I don't know why they don't know. I don't know why they're making such a big deal of this. There's one last passage. Jesus goes up to the temple on a feast day. Everybody is there. Everybody's there. And he's teaching. So not only is everybody there, but he's standing up in front of everybody teaching. And there's some discussion about, it appears that it's about a healing that he had done previously. And Jesus says, I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses has given you circumcision. And even on a Sabbath day, you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses will not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? And then there's more discussion. So, like I said, so those are the passages. That's the context. That's what's been stuck in my head for years now. I cannot figure this thing out. I've always wondered why Jesus is making such a big deal out of this. He's intentionally going out of his way to provoke, if not a conflict, which seems like that's true, maybe just a conversation with the religious establishment about the Sabbath. He's intentionally baiting them with these healings and with his questions. So I was thinking about that. Like he's doing things. He knows they're going to react. He knows how they're going to react. If you have children or have ever had a sibling, you know how to get them to react. You know exactly what to say, exactly where to poke to get them to do something. And you know how to do that because you know how they think. I don't understand how the Pharisees are thinking. I don't know what's going on in their heads. Jesus does. He knows exactly what's going on because all he has to do is poke. And he gets, I don't know if it's the reaction he was hoping for, but it's definitely a reaction. And so I think perhaps part of why I don't understand what they were thinking was that, or is that 21st century Western culture is significantly different than first century Jewish culture. I think there's probably some significant differences there which make it hard for me to understand what's going on in their heads. Part of that is that in Western culture, we kind of have 9 commandments and a suggestion. So the 9 commandments would be, have no other gods before me, don't make any idols, don't take the Lord, name of the Lord your God in vain, honor your father and mother, don't commit murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness, and do not covet. There's 9. There's a significant one here we missed, which seems to be more of a suggestion, and that's remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Why do we consider it a sin to break any of those other commandments? If you stole something, it's a sin, for sure. If you lie about something, it's a sin. If you murder someone, it's like no problem on any of these, but the Sabbath day is tricky, and maybe that's why in our culture there it's more like a suggestion. Maybe it's because so this is rolling around in my head, thinking maybe it's because it's so hard to define what work is. You're not supposed to do any work on the Sabbath. So is it like the scientific definition of work? You know, exerting effort, energy is expended, and something moves. That's probably not what God was talking about. Is it making money on the Sabbath? So don't pick up the rent check on Sunday. The Jews, I think, had a similar issue with what exactly you were allowed to do and not allowed to do on the Sabbath. They had 39 categories. So this was in the first century. They had 39 categories. Apparently, I don't know if pushing buttons falls in one of these categories or not, or maybe there are more categories now. They had 39 categories of activities, not 39 activities you couldn't do. 39 sets of things that you could not do. That seemed like a lot, so I didn't go into the study of all the things that you couldn't do on the Sabbath. But that's a lot of things. It's a hard question to answer. Is work the same for every person? Does it just mean lack of activity? What if I mow a lawn? My job is mowing lawns. I probably shouldn't mow lawns on Sunday or on my Sabbath day. But if I work in an office and I'm stuck inside every day all day long and I love getting outside and just riding around the yard on that mower, am I allowed to do that? Is it so hard to define because it means something different for each of us? We're getting there. We're getting there, guys. We don't spend, in our culture, we don't spend a whole lot of time exercising Sabbath, except that it means try not to earn income on the Sabbath day, unless, of course, it's terribly inconvenient not to. So again, it seems to be a suggestion. So, there's something going on in the Pharisees' heads. It's something about Sabbath. It's something I don't understand. And I will finally tell you what came about as I was reading through Exodus 31 that answered this question for me. Exodus 31, verse 12. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "You are to speak to the people of Israel and say, 'Above all, you shall keep my Sabbaths.'" From Exodus chapter 20 to Exodus chapter 31, it is 11 chapters, well, it's 10 and a half chapters of instruction on what you should do, what you should not do, and how to worship God. And then God stops and he says, "I just gave you 10 chapters of things to do and not to do, but above all else, keep my Sabbath." But he doesn't say it just one time. A few chapters later, chapter 35, Moses assembles all the congregation. He says to them, "These are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do." He's giving them all of the law. But he sums it up in this. He doesn't tell them all the law in this particular place. He just says, 6 days, work may be done. But on the seventh day, you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. God stops everybody twice. And he says, above all else, stop and take a Sabbath. That's why the Pharisees were so wound up about this. They were kind of wound up about a lot of things. But they seemed particularly wound up about this thing. And that's why, because God said so. God said, above all else, you will keep the Sabbath. And Jesus was going intentionally out of his way to break the Sabbath. So that means that Jesus understood something about the Sabbath that they did not understand. Now, I'm sure this has been spoken from right in front of this lectern a few times before, but we'll say it again. The Sabbath is a big deal because God said so, not this particular thing. I'm getting to a point. God said we should have a Sabbath. We know we have something to practice. But the Pharisees didn't quite understand how to practice it or why to practice it. And I think sometimes it's hard for us as well. But that same passage, Exodus 31, just a little bit later, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "You are to speak to the people of Israel and say, 'Above all, keep my Sabbath, for this is a sign between me and you through all your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you.'" It's a sign, and then verse 17, "It's a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, but on the seventh day he ceased from labor and was refreshed." On the seventh day he ceased from labor and was refreshed. If you work every day, there's two things here that I'm going to point out. One is that if you work every day, you're going to be too tired. God said so. Even in this broken world where we eat by the sweat of our brow, where living does not come easily, where it's just a constant struggle, God says, "I know. I understand. Stop. Stop. You need it." And the second reason, probably, you know, existentially speaking, the more important one is that we know that it is the Lord that sanctifies us. This passage, this is God setting up a system. This is in the middle of instructions for the tabernacle. God is setting up a system so that an unholy people can interact with a holy God and be in a relationship with him. He's saying it's not the system of sacrifices. It's I that make you holy. So like I said, I got to about this point in the message, in my preparation, and I said, you know what? I don't want to talk about the Sabbath day. I don't want to talk about how and why it should be practiced. I want to talk about Jesus. I want to highlight Jesus. I want to know Him and Him crucified. That's the dish I want to bring this morning. It felt like all of that, you know, although it's really good stuff, it's marshmallow fluff. I want some meat and potatoes here. And then I realized that the Sabbath is not the principle. The Sabbath is just the illustration of the principle. The principle is that the best system of religion, the one that was ordained by God and given to man in enormous detail and instruction, that system cannot make us holy. It cannot bring us into a relationship with Him. There's only one way that can happen, and that's through the man Jesus Christ. He's the only way we can be holy. He's the only way we can be sanctified. He's the only way that we can be in a relationship with God, the relationship we were created for. He's the only way that our souls can be refreshed. The Sabbath is the illustration. It highlights, it works like the law. It highlights our issues. It shows us our problems, and it points us to Jesus. And then it tells us to sit still and think about all of those things. Man was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. God gave us this day not to be a burden of making sure that you are not doing anything in any of the categories of things that ought not be done. He gave us this as a blessing. And that's why it's a commandment, not a suggestion. Because it's necessary for us to regularly and consciously orient ourselves to the truth that in Jesus, only in Jesus, only in the author and perfecter of our faith can we truly be refreshed. And only in Him can we truly be sanctified. And only when we are sanctified in Him can we be in the relationship with God that we are intended for. Jesus wasn't fighting the Pharisees because they had missed the point, although they definitely had missed the point. He was fighting with the Pharisees because He was the point. It's not about following a list of do's and don'ts. It's about coming to the one who is able to give us everything. It's about realizing just how puny our very puny efforts are to provide even the basic necessities of life. Don't go work the field. I know winter's coming. Stop. Don't do it. Because that effort is so worthless. When we stop, we can remember to turn our eyes on the one who is able to do far above all that we can ask or imagine. And when we have properly oriented ourselves, then we can find rest and our souls can be refreshed. So I'm also supposed to share this morning. So that's that. It's Jesus. That's why the Sabbath, because it's a picture of Jesus. I'm also supposed to give a little update on my family, and it actually works really well. Like I said, you know, as you're preparing things, they seem to all go together. It's like somebody's planned this out for us or something. So I'll read this little piece. I was doing some sharing time a couple months back about leaving Azerbaijan. So I'll read this piece, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on with our family. April 1st, at about 20 after 12 last year, I got a call from the bookkeeper of our company, the company I get my visa through, and she said immigration wanted to talk to me. 7 hours later, my visa had been canceled, my bags were packed, and I was sitting on an airplane waiting to take off, and life The life that I'd been living for the last 11 years was over. And during those 7 hours between that phone call and sitting on that airplane, I had an incredible sense of peace. I didn't know what was going to happen. And there was nothing at all I could do to change the outcome. Nothing. So sometime later that night, or the next day, I don't know, it gets fuzzy when you fly late at night. I was about 30,000 feet over the Atlantic Ocean, and I found myself wondering, how over is my life? I've heard stories about people who felt like they had completed their task, and then the next week they have a car accident, so I'm like, fly across, and I'm wondering if we're actually going to land in North America or not. And I found, like, as I'm thinking about that, I was at peace either way. Either I make it or I don't. Either way, I'm okay with it. There is something completely freeing about knowing that life, as you know it, is completely over. You have no idea what's next. And right now, there isn't a single thing you can do to move the process forward in any other direction. But God is completely in control. And so as I'm kind of sleepily thinking through these things, flying across the Atlantic Ocean, I very consciously took my hands off the metaphoric wheel and committed myself completely into his hands. Since then, my outlook in life, which is significantly different than before, my outlook in life can be described probably best as floating down a river on an inner tube. I go where the current takes me. If you like a bit more excitement, maybe it's like riding on a roller coaster. You're strapped in and it's going, but you still have no choice in the matter. I had a chat with a pastor a few months ago, and he said something that stuck out to me. He said he was starting to do a new thing, and God highlighted something to him. He said, I feel like God was asking me to plan less and pray more. And I thought, you know what? I think God is asking me to plan less and pray more. So that's kind of where we are as a family right now. We are praying more. We're planning less. We're floating down the river of life with no idea where the steering wheel even is. And completely confident and at peace that he has steered us to the place we are right now. And confident that he is taking us to the place that we are going to go. And those places are the best places for us to be. So in a little over a month or less than a month from now, my family is going to get on another airplane. But this time we're going to do it because we want to. And we are going to fly to Turkey. Can you pull a map of Turkey up there for me? All right. Can you just grab Google Maps and put the browser over there? That's easier. June 21st is our takeoff date. Let me know when you get that. So Turkey and Azerbaijan have remarkably similar cultures and languages. They're both Turkic cultures. They're both Turkic languages. Azerbaijani and Turkey are about 80% similar in language. So although we are starting most of the way over, we aren't starting all the way over. We spent about 6 months wondering about what might be next, and then we thought Turkey might be next. And so we went to Turkey in January, my wife and I. We left the kids in Minnesota. And we went and we did that thing where we prayed more and planned less and walked through, I think, 8 or 10 cities and just listened to what God might be saying. We didn't go looking for a green light. Those are difficult. We didn't get a word from the Lord or a letter or anything. We went saying, Lord, I think this seems to be open. This seems to be next. If there is a red light, make sure we can see it. And so we were just about done with that trip. We were about 2 days from finishing, and I said, you know what, I think that we're going to need to change our language from if we move to Turkey to when we move to Turkey, because there hasn't been anything to suggest that we should not come. I was going to show you a map of where it is, but yeah? No? All right. It's okay. So then I'll just tell you, if you pull up Google Maps on a phone or a computer, zoom in on the word Turkey, just to the left of the T in Turkey is where I will be living. It's a little town called Avanos. And so for the first 2 years, we are going to learn language, and we're going to learn culture, and we're going to spend a lot of time praying. There's actually a building there that has a basement that's a cave, and we will be using the cave as a prayer room for a while. There it is. All right, yeah, just zoom in. If you can. There you go. You're doing good. Yeah, a little left. Keep going. No. Right on the word Turkey. Zoom in on Turkey. Yeah. There you go. Stop. Here's Avanos. That's the town we'll be living in. That was much more effort than necessary. Thank you. Avanos. That's one right here. Yeah. By the way, these guys in the back are doing a fantastic job all the time. We only ever notice them when it doesn't work. But I would like to thank you right now for making things work for us. So yeah, that's where my family will be. We feel like we left Azerbaijan and it was like that was all over. It was incredibly, it was a much less difficult experience leaving Azerbaijan than you might think after having been there for 11 years. 10 days before, I don't know if I said this here or not, but 10 days before I left Azerbaijan, I had this sense that I was taking a walk in the morning, I was praying, I was thinking, and I felt like, you know, I think the thing that I've been doing, I'd been working with the local pastors and trying to get them to, I've been trying to get a sense of unity among them, getting them together, getting them into relationship. It was like herding cats. I felt like, you know what? I think this thing that I've been doing, I think I did it. I think that I am no longer necessary to this process. Up until this point, it would not have gone without me. At this point, I really feel like push the snowball to the top of the hill, and it's on the other side. I'm not sure it's going to go well, but it could go, and it definitely can go without me. And so a couple days later, I said something to Krista about it. Or maybe it was that day I said something to Krista about it, and she said, okay. I said, you know, I think I'm no longer necessary to the process. I think I'm still useful, so let's see how I'm still useful. And then a week later, I said the same thing, and she said, Ryan, stop saying, if I leave Azerbaijan tomorrow. And then 2 days later, I was on an airplane. So the Lord, in his grace, had given me 10 days to sit in the idea that my time there was done. So when it came time to get on the airplane, I thought, well, I guess I knew my time was done. I didn't know it was done this quick or like this, but leaving Azerbaijan wasn't nearly as difficult. In that sense, I don't think a lot of people get to feel like they've accomplished the thing that they went to do, especially in that sense. And so Krista and I talked and we thought, you know what, I don't think we're done there, but I don't think we're done. And so we're heading back out to Turkey and we will see what the Lord is going to do through us there. We're excited to see what he is going to do. We don't know what it's going to be. We're going to try to build a team there in Turkey and hopefully send people farther east. Most of the Christians in Turkey live in all the way on the west side in the big cities, Istanbul, Izmir, Ankara. There's very few Christians farther east, so we'll see what we can do about that. It appears there's a single lady that's going to come join us. Her name's Becca, and she felt like the Lord said to her when we were there. She came on the vision trip in January, and she felt like God asked her, "Are you okay with spending your life in Turkey, chipping away at rocks, so that the next generation might be able to plant?" I'm okay with that. So maybe I will go chip rocks for the next, 40 or 50 years, as long as the Lord allows. What I do know is I will pray and remember that Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, keep our eyes focused on him. That's all I have prepared. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer a few. If you're not, we can go from here.
Are you with some mission?
Oh, several. I'm with several, yes. We're with Bethany out of Minnesota. We're also with one called Connect, which is based in Thailand.
I mean, that would be the same in Turkey.
That is correct, yep. Mm-hmm. All right.
Can you clarify some of your duties and responsibilities?
Maybe. Yeah, so for Bethany, I am the regional leader for Bethany. I'm one of the regional leaders for Bethany. The region that I oversee, you want to zoom out? Hey, keep going a ways. A little more. Yeah, stop there. Basically, from China to Europe, below Russia and above India. That is the area that I oversee. Just that. There's not that many people there, so it seems like it's a lot more square mileage than it is human beings. But I will be helping build teams in Tajikistan, the Republic of Georgia, then in Turkey, and then whatever else they come up with that they want to put people in. So that is my responsibilities with Bethany. Besides that, I don't have any explicit responsibilities. Does that clarify some things? I was in Tajikistan about 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and it was one of those experiences where I felt like, oh. You know, it was long and hard work in Azerbaijan, and there was some good fruit at the end, but a lot of that I don't know. I have no idea what happened, what was going on. We say, all things work together for good. I believe that. I just don't know when I'm going to figure out how that was good. When I was in Tajikistan, it felt like all of the things, the experiences, the practice that I got to do over the last 11 years in Azerbaijan. I kind of got to Tajikistan, and I got out my toolbox, and all of the tools were out on the table, and I got to use them all, and I got to use them fairly competently, and I was like, oh, that's part of what all of that was about. So I'm excited for this next season. That was in my role as a region leader. It feels like I've been prepared well to do a thing. In my life, there are very few things that I feel like I've been prepared well to do. I've done a whole lot of things that were like, hey, did you see it done once? Great, you're up, go. I did a lot of that, but it feels good to be prepared well to do a thing. So.
What is your sense, Ryan, of the body there in Turkey?
It's really skinny. There's maybe 10,000 Christians in Turkey total, out of about 80 million people. It's about 0.1% of the population. There are churches. They have a tendency to be really territorial and fight with each other a lot. In the area we're going to live, there's maybe 3 believers in the surrounding, if you make a 25-mile circle around there. Those are Turkic believers. There's about 1,000 Iranian believers that are refugees in a nearby city. But Iranians and Turks don't get along real well, so there's not a whole lot of... they're not doing a whole lot of work. They're also refugees, so they don't want to make too many waves and get sent back to Iran. So the church in Turkey, although Turkey used to be a Christian country, or that area used to be Christian, is entirely culturally Muslim. About 60%... entirely culturally Muslim. About 20% of them are practicing Muslims. 80% of the whole country would say that they're Muslims. So it's in that context that there's a very kind of weak church there. Yes, ma'am.
Are you allowed to preach the gospel?
Not like this. Not like I'm doing this morning. It's from what I understand, and I don't have all the nuances yet, but foreigners are not allowed to lead religious gatherings. So if I'm up in the front, that's not allowed. Turks are allowed to do it. Turks are allowed to have churches and lead churches and that sort of thing. Conversations are generally okay as long as you don't make waves. You don't want to, like, just go strike up a conversation with anybody. But then again, it's an Eastern culture, so nothing happens there without a relationship. So you're going to build a relationship with someone first, and it's okay if they know that you're a Christian, but you're probably not going to share the gospel with them on the first at the first conversation, generally. Yeah. Which it was the same as it was in Azerbaijan, and I did all sorts of things in Azerbaijan. I'm also not in Azerbaijan anymore, so... Maybe should reevaluate some of those activities. All right, well, let me pray for us as we go. Father, thank you so much for this body that you've created for us to be a part of. We hear from you so much better when we're together. Thank you for this wonderful feast that you've prepared for us this morning. Thank you for each one of us that you've highlighted something to that could come and share it. Jesus, as we go out into another week, let us not lose that sense. Let us not forget the things that you've taught us. Let us keep our eyes on you. Amen.